The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hyde. This week our guest is the U.S. National Editor and columnist at the Financial Times, Ed Luce, author of a great new biography of Zbigniew Brzezinski. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, ZBiotics and Fay Nutrition, in our show notes. We thank you for supporting them because it really helps make this podcast happen. James, the big story, of course, is Los Angeles. The largely peaceful demonstrations against ICE, which has intimidated neighborhoods, restaurants, even schools. Trump used it as a pretext to federalize the National Guard, send in the Marines. He only has one purpose here. He wants to inflame tensions, violence, and his fondest dreams, a race riot. You know, they're rushing to meet Stephen Miller's stupid quota of 3,000 deportations a day, get them anywhere, and detract attention from the unpopular bill back in Washington that cuts Medicaid spending to help extend tax cuts for the rich. James, my mind dashes back to the histories I've read of the 1933 Reichstag fire, which Hitler used as a pretext for the Enabling Act, suspending civil liberties and ushering in the end of democracy for Nazi Germany. This is what authoritarians do. They create disorder, crisis, and claim they're the only ones that can deal with it, that can fix it. He's going to do the same thing to other cities. He's going to inflame tensions. He's going to send troops in unless the courts rise to the occasion and declare this is illegal. You know, your Marine Corps is trained to fight a foreign enemy, not to be used by a lawless politician to combat domestic protest. And I'll tell you, my greatest fear, at the risk of being seen as a conspiracy nut, is that a little over a year from now, Trump uses the same tactics, the Insurrection Act, the Alien Enemies Act, to foment chaos and claim the midterm elections have to be sidelined. I don't know that I'm predicting that'll happen, but does anyone think that Trump wouldn't do it if he thought he could get away with it?
Well, of course, everything you say is true. And I will mind over years and years of experience in watching things is trained to think within the confines of certain things. These people are in the confines of nothing. You understand? Nothing. And the guy that's kind of impressed me in this, and we've had him on the show before, and I want to get him back, is Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who correctly pointed out that, well, let's see, the big, beautiful bill is in terrible trouble. They've probably been told that they don't have near the votes in the Senate to pass anything close to what they want. Every day it sits out there, it rots, it stinks more. And in our outrage, I'll give further implications of what I think this is. But this is correct. This is a giant distraction movement. It has the added benefit of maybe the potential of having a race war. I would warn people, I live in New Orleans, Louisiana. In the initial skirmish of the race war, I'm not going to do very well. All right? But I mean, I do think that in the White House is telling journalists, and you see this everywhere, thank God for Los Angeles. It took the heat away from us. All right?
They gave high fives.
After we're high-fiving each other, because that's now out of the question, and the the Sunday morning crowd is going to say that he's done a good job. He's shifted the dialogue. We're going to have a panel discussion on the Democrats' problems with male voters following this up. And now he's on the issue terrain that he wants to be on. I can hear this shit. You can hear it. It's already been talked about. It's going to be talked about more. And to that extent, this is working for him. This is working for him. We're not talking about all the failures, and we're not talking about the fact that his trade policy has blown the world up. We're not talking that he's caved to China. We're not talking about the World Bank cutting the future growth rate by something like in half, maybe. We're not talking about any of that, where he's leading people around by their nose. And what he knows is how to distract us from the big manifest stuff that's at hand. And congratulations for Senator Murphy for speaking up what the real motivation is behind this. And that is that you don't pay attention to all the crappy things that he's trying to do. And the fact that he had done from day one, and the Ukraine war is going on more vigorously than it ever has. So we can agree on all that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the politics are unsettling. That's a reflection of the Biden administration's failures, I think, on border issues until the final months. Gavin Newsom, I also believe, gave a powerful rejoinder to Trump. And I politics are bad right now. I think Trump may overplay his hand. He has a tendency to do that, particularly when he thinks he's riding high. But James, let me offer some good news amid all this, okay?
Sure.
New Jersey Democrats this week nominated Mikey Sherrill to be their candidate for governor this year. Mikey Sherrill, she's a Navy helicopter veteran. She was elected in 2018. She's a moderate, smart Democrat. Two gubernatorial races this year. The Democratic candidates are going to be Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey and Abigail Spanberger, a former CIA officer in Virginia. They really are the poster childs of 2018 when they won. They both beat Republican incumbents. And I think there'll be a lot of attention to those two races because that's the ball game. And boy, I think the Democrats have two really good candidates.
Well, okay, let's dig a little bit deep into the New Jersey election. And Mikey Sherrill and another congressman named Josh Gotham are pretty much representing what I would call the same left of center. And then there were the mayor of Newark and the mayor of another city, I think, Jersey City maybe, ran as the progressive candidates. In a Democratic primary in New Jersey, okay, the combined left of center vote was 10 points higher than the left of left vote. These people have very little power. We have to understand that. They're not even popular in the Democratic Party. So how are we going to take them to the next level? There was one other thing that I caught my fantasy in New Jersey, and I think this is underappreciated. On the Republican side, I think it's Cicciarelli is his name.
Yeah, the guy ran last time against Bill Murphy.
He ran last time. He came much closer than I anticipated. He was the de facto default nominee. He was endorsed by Trump. But tell you something interesting, Albert. He got 67%. That means that one-third of the New Jersey Republicans, one-third that turned out to vote in that primary, went against Trump. All right? If that's a warning sign, that means something. That's not an inconsequential number at all.
Yep.
And
yep.
I'm almost sure, but I could stand corrected, that he didn't spend any money. Basically didn't raise any. And you're starting to see the other thing that was a special in the first congressional district of Florida. It's overwhelmed. Matt Gaetz's home district. They're underperformed by like 7 points, which is pretty consistent with everything that's happened in the country. So very good news. We got two really strong gubernatorial candidates. And this fits into what you and I have said for a long time. There's a bucket load of talent in the Democratic Party. Some of that talent is going to be on display in the gubernatorial races in New Jersey and Virginia. And we're just getting warmed up because these two outstanding public servants are going to win. I hope that they may win by a lot. I bet you that maybe Virginia will win by more than New Jersey. I don't know that. But that's, and then right after that, we're going to go on. We're going to have good recruiting in 2026. But I'm telling Democrats is, if you put your ear to the ground, you can hear the cavalry coming, and it's coming. And we got some talented people.
Yeah.
Believe me.
Boy, James, the first two candidates I covered in end of 2017, early 2018, were Mikey Sherrill and Spanberger. I was really impressed with Abigail Spanberger, and Mikey Sherrill knocked my socks off. Those were, as I said, this is the 2018 game book. And it was a pretty goddamn good game book.
It worked. It worked.
Yeah, it worked.
I don't know. Yeah. We tried to do something else. Okay, we went from Maggie Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger in that just stunningly talented class. And I think Ruben was in that class. I mean, it was probably Jason Crow. It was one of the most talented freshman class of congressional elected candidates in the history of the United States. And for idiotic reasons, we got jerked into this stupid identity garbage, of which people rejected. But thank God, Democratic Party is returning to its roots and turning to the things that work for it, turning to things that people look to the Democratic Party for. And this, and you're right, I remember those two pieces you wrote. You were very high on both of these women. That should be acknowledged, but I'm telling you, people, the cavalry is on the way.
Yep.
It's on the way. Despair not.
Yeah, you know, and the concern of some is that Democrats sometimes come across as too weak and woke, as it's put. I'll tell you one thing. The former CIA agent, Spanberger, and the former Navy helicopter pilot, Naval Academy graduate, Sherrill, they are not weak, and they are sure as hell not woke.
No.
And
remember, in the Democratic primary in New Jersey, very important, I would tell my, quote, progressive, unquote, friends, you didn't do very well. Democrats don't much like you. So let's all get on the bandwagon and get behind these two candidates. And I don't want to devalue that one-third of Republicans didn't vote for the candidate they were supposed to.
Yeah. James, I just want one more footnote before we go, because the Trump administration is so corrupt that other ethical transgressions sometimes get overlooked. Mark Green, a Tennessee congressman, says he's resigning from Congress to take a very lucrative private sector job.
Oh.
But he's not going to resign until the reconciliation bill, you know, the big, beautiful one, until that passes. And he won't tell us what job he's going to take. You don't think by any chance, James, that Green or his future employer could be affected by what's in that big, beautiful bill?
Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me?
Oh,
And the problem is this, Alvin. You know this. That's the 12th most interesting story out there.
And the 12th most unethical, right.
Yeah,
exactly.
He's in maybe high single A ball, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, that's about it.
James, I suspect that Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger will have better things to do on Saturday than attend this military parade, which is supposed to be a normal parade commemorating the 250th anniversary of the United States Army, you know, which I think is highly desirable. Of course, Trump has turned it into an extravaganza that really is intended to celebrate his 79th birthday. It's the sort of thing you saw in North Korea. I just want to caution that I think that the resistance groups have been setting up all around the country as a counter, and I think very effectively. I have a small worry that somehow this gets mixed up with the anti-ICE demonstrations. Because what the demonstrations want to do on Saturday is draw a contrast between the dictator in Washington trying to have a parade in his honor and people around the country peacefully protesting what's going on in America. If they can pull that off, I think actually it'll be effective and it will hurt Trump a little.
Also, there's a little counter-scheduling going on, as we call it in the trade.
Yeah, it seems
that Pope Leo will be visiting his hometown of Chicago and will have a mass. And this will contrast nicely with the whatever he's doing. I mean, I understand the outrage here. The United States Army is 250 years old. It is probably the most distinguished fighting force in modern world history. I mean, like I could call LaRoe. You want to try George Washington? You want to try U.S. Grant? You want to try Dwight Eisenhower? You want to try Artie Murphy? You want to try Sergeant York? Okay. Colin Powell? You name it. The United States Army is probably the foremost fighting force in modern history. And of course, we're not going to be able, he has hijacked a celebration of, I was born on an Army post. I was out in California with the Infinite, with my Fort Ord, where my daddy was stationed when he was in the Army. And they have hijacked this. And the crime of it is that all the necessary honoring of the United States Army and remembering all of the great battles it fought, remembering all of the great things that it's done, is he's subjugated it to an ego demonstration for him. It's so disgraceful. It's so disrespectful of the Army, the people that served in it, the families of the people that have served in the Army, the people that are in cemeteries all over this country, about all over Europe, okay, that were in the United States Army. And this is a goddamn disgrace. And that's the most disgraceful thing. It's horrible that it's an ego thing for him. And it's horrible that they're going to cause $16 million of damage to the Washington Street. That's not the real disgrace. The real disgrace is we should have a chance where we honor all of the great things that all of the soldiers in history have done, and I got to look at this fat shit. So that's what, James, that's what really pisses me off.
James, are you referring to those soldiers that Trump has called suckers?
Yeah.
Are those the same ones?
That's exactly the people I'm talking about. Yes. Thank you for reminding me, and we know he said it, because General Mattis told, or it was General Kelly, I'm sorry, told Jeffrey Goldberg. And we know that. It's been verified. It's not hearsay. It's not secondhand information. It's not any of that. That's what he said. And he wants to interject his fat, stupid, unpatriotic self in the middle of a celebration of the greatest fighting force in the history of the modern world. I don't like it. You're right. You're asking me after I flew from Los Angeles to New Orleans last night and got into Woodford Reserve on the plane, having to do this podcast today? Yes, and Barton.
I hope you had Z-Biotics on that plane.
You know, I got them when I got, I have them at home. And let me give you a personal testimony. That this is an important, you need to know about this, and it'll help you get through it.
Listen, after a night with drinks, now, we got to be honest, James. We don't bounce back the way we used to. I'm sorry. That's one of the prices of age. But, you know, it used to be a big decision. You want a great night or a great next day. Luckily, with pre-alcohol, you don't have to compromise. To fill you in, Z-Biotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. They were thinking of you and me, James. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme that breaks this byproduct down. Just remember, you really have to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Then drink responsibly, and you're going to feel your best the next day. Thanks to Z-Biotics, James even goes on long runs after his long nights. And every time you have a Z-Biotics pre-alcohol before drink, it makes such a difference. Whether you're writing all day, exercising, or even going in front of an audience, Z-Biotics is the MVP when it counts. After all, summer's here, which means more opportunities to celebrate the warm weather. So before that backyard barbecue brew, glass of Pinot, watching the sunset at the beach, or cocktail by campfire, don't forget your Z-Biotics pre-alcohol. Just drink one before drinking and wake up feeling great and ready to take on the next day and all that this summer has to offer. So go to zbiotics.com/PWR to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use PWR at checkout. Zbiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/PWR and use the code PWR at checkout for 15% off. The link is also in our show notes.
Enjoy Z-Biotics and a great night out.
Hey, James, since World War II, there have been only, I don't know, four or five genuine American global strategic thinkers. One was Zbigniew Brzezinski, advisor to presidents from John F. Kennedy through Barack Obama. He was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. Ed Luce, the chief U.S. commentator and columnist for the Financial Times, has written a compelling biography of Zbig. Ed, I was an admirer of Zbigniew Brzezinski. I think your book captures him, the mostly good, some deficiencies. What is the Brzezinski legacy?
That's a really good question. I mean, the thing that first drew me to this is just the story. You know, biography is first and foremost a story, and it's kind of cinematic, so sort of dark cinema as well as light cinema. The interwar Warsaw upbringing in that brief sort of period of Polish nation, Second Republic, before it's extinguished, ending, you know, in the early months of Trump's first administration. That is an extraordinary story in and of itself, but how he became the making of a grand strategist, and I would agree with your question, you know, I'd put sort of just purely in terms of strategist as opposed to diplomatic practitioner, which was not Brzezinski's forte. There were really three: the godfather, George Kennan, who created containment and the original Cold War strategy, and then Kissinger and Brzezinski. Others, I mean, I guess Dean Acheson, of course, as well at the beginning, but others like George Shultz and Jim Baker were great diplomatic practitioners. But so what is it that goes up to make into the making of a strategic brain, which we are sorely lacking in today's...
Oh, my God, yes. You know, Ed, he was Carter's national security advisor, but like his boss, they until recently got very little credit. They were remembered for a long time, mainly for the Iranian hostage crisis. Yet in those 4 years, they normalized relations with China. The Camp David, Egypt-Israel peace accords was the most significant Mideast achievement, despite the current chaos. They negotiated Panama Canal treaties, and they stood up to the Soviet Union after it invaded Afghanistan. That's not a bad record, Ed.
Yeah, and if I could add one, because history never thanks you for what didn't happen, but the Soviet non-invasion of Poland, right. Brzezinski and the Pope, of course, the Polish-born Pope's ability to convince Brezhnev, a drunk and often sort of not in control of his faculties, Leonid Brezhnev, that Poland would be indigestible, that it would be a porcupine, is something that's, you know, I think underrated, because that would have, Poland is like many times more important than Czechoslovakia in 1968 or Hungary in 1956. Poland was the significant weak link in the Soviet chain. And preventing that is something that where full credit is yet to be given. But of course, he deserves a lot of blame for the advice he gave to Jimmy Carter on Iran. This isn't a hagiography, in other words.
No, he made mistakes. I mean, we can talk about some of those later. Vietnam in the beginning was obviously a mistake. But the arc of his career, which you capture so well, was extraordinary. A Cold War hawk. When I first came to Washington, the left hated him. He was enemy number one.
He was Darth Vader, right?
Oh, my God. A Democrat who embraced Republicans in the last part of the 20th century. And then in the first part of this century, to use a cliche, he was a national security dove. Actually, I think a realist, opposing the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. That's one hell of an arc, Ed.
That's a pretty remarkable arc. But I think his regret at not coming out against Vietnam sooner, because you remember, by 1968, he's the foreign policy issues director for Hubert Humphrey, and he's
right.
Actually agitating for Humphrey to distance himself much more from LBJ, which happens tragically late for Humphrey's campaign. But I think it was embarrassment at not having turned against Vietnam sooner that made him pretty quick off the starting blocks, along with Brent Scowcroft, over the 2003 Iraq War. But of course, you, Al, play a very good, important cameo role in this book, because I think it was to you on Bloomberg TV that Zbig announced in 2007 he was endorsing Barack Obama at that critical stage in the Iowa primaries, August 2007, the Iowa caucuses, where Obama's meteor is falling and Hillary Clinton's resurging, and she has the 3 a.m. ad out that who would you trust to pick up the phone at 3 a.m.? And Zbig's earlier avatar as the Darth Vader was a punch the air moment for the Obama campaign, and he told you on he revealed the news to Al Hunt.
Well, I would love to say I was prescient. I anticipated that. I was shocked. We were supposed to be talking about foreign policy, but he did, and he knew what he was doing. He got that, you know, that sly look he could get in his face when he did it. He was very happy with himself. His occasional friend and often rival was Henry Kissinger. They both were wrong in Vietnam, though, as you know. Brzezinski realized and recognized the mistake. Kissinger never really did. But so I think the Brzezinski record is actually far more impressive than the Kissinger record. But he was never celebrated in establishment circles like Kissinger. Why?
So I think he had sharp elbows. I mean, each of them, of course, Kissinger and Brzezinski did have a lot in common. They were foreign accented, you know, academic luminaries in the Cold War university of Harvard and Columbia in the 50s and 60s. But they had very different ways of dealing with people who doubted their Americanness to take these top jobs. And in Kissinger's case, it was through flattery and seduction. And I think he was a sort of gold Olympic medal winning flatterer.
He was an adapter.
And, you know, even with me, by the way, I mean, he was very generous with his time for this biography. Right up until after he was 100. Even with me, he would sort of say things I knew patently to be untrue about how he always read my column first thing every morning. I was like, that's Henry Kissinger. Brzezinski would specialize in decapitating people he thought were fools, verbally decapitating, I should add. He just went for the jugular. There was something of that romantic Polish cavalry charge, the last real cavalry charge in history, in European history, about Brzezinski. And that made a lot of enemies. I mean, I think on the upside, people didn't doubt his sincerity or integrity. He wasn't a duplicitous or wily operator. But that meant he had a lot more detractors than Kissinger did, at least until the real backlash came to, you know, the bombing of Cambodia and all that kind of stuff. But very different styles.
It was totally, you know, totally straightforward, honest. He was not an adapter. James Carville?
So, Ed, here you are. I guess he would call you his Boswell or some kind of shit like that. So give us the benefit of what his counsel would be today on Ukraine. What would he think? Because this is his, obviously, this is right in his wheelhouse, to say the least. And what do you think he would be? Would it advise the U.S. president to do when Ukraine was invaded by the Russians? What would his insight be?
he had, just as a preface to your question, to my answer, James, he had a pretty good predictive record on Ukraine, and wrote that, you know, Putin repeatedly warned that Putin would try and regain it. And he famously wrote in his book, The Grand Chessboard, 1997, that Russia with Ukraine is a Eurasian empire. Russia without Ukraine is in trouble. And as somebody, you know, with Polish roots, he understood in a way that Poles and Ukrainians, only they really do, that the fates of Poland and Ukraine are linked. That's always right. Been a historic sort of lesson there. So he warned that this would happen. He warned there would be an alliance of the aggrieved after the Cold War ended. You know, he wasn't really in tune with the triumphalism that you saw amongst some after the end of the Cold War. He saw problems ahead. So he became a bit of a, he became a little bit pessimistic, having been the real optimist during the Cold War. But I think also prescient, because that alliance of the aggrieved, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, you know, was there with Putin looking over Red Square last month. Xi Jinping standing by his side, this time with China as the big brother and Russia as the little brother. Interestingly, he did not support Ukraine's membership of NATO. He believed it, after Putin annexed Crimea, he wrote an op-ed in the FT, in fact, saying that it should be Finlandized. It should become basically a buffer state between NATO and Russia. But I think the invasion of, you know, I'm projecting maybe a little bit here, but the invasion of since 2022, he would have been a much more hawkish voice, and I think he would be completely contemptuous of the Trump administration's approach to so-called diplomacy in this situation. You don't offer all the concessions to the aggressor before the talks have begun. You're supposed to hold them back as an incentive for them to conclude a reasonable settlement, to conclude the talks. So I think but this wouldn't differentiate himself from anybody, to Kissinger included, he would find the Trump-Rubio Witkoff approach to Putin to be laughable.
So, again, because we asked him to project in somebody that's now deceased into sort of current events, but I got to ask you this, because the question just sits here like that. How appalled would he be at Donald Trump being back in office and doing the things that he's doing? I mean, he would have definitely had some very strong opinions on this, wouldn't he?
He would have. I mean, he died about 3-4 months into Trump's first term. And one of his last public events was when the outgoing defense secretary, Ashton Carter, the tragically late Ashton Carter now, as defense secretary, awarded Brzezinski the highest civilian honor you can get from the Pentagon. Brzezinski did speak a little bit at that event. In what one observer, David Ignatius, was there. Said it was like a fever dream of worry about what Trumpism would mean and the turn America might be taking. So, I mean, he clearly felt sort of deep anxiety about that change. And you know, Trump 2.0 is more than twice. It's more worrying than that, because it is the American electorate going back to somebody who they know well. And I think that would have worried him about allies. He did value alliances.
Yeah, I'll talk about you, but a quick point to you. This is not a book that's just about history. I mean, I think with this guy, knew his worldview, his real understanding, maybe above all, of that kind of Poland, Ukraine, something that whole part of the world, really beneficial. I think there's a lot to learn from what you've done. That really applicable today. It's not just, you know, just reading about some ancient guy that did something. He really would have been, you know, understood this. So congratulations on not just a really good book, but a really, really relevant book that stands up today as being very important for people to have. So my congratulations, Albert.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I totally agree. He only lived in Poland for several years, Ed, but you note throughout the book that his Polish roots were central to Zbigniew Brzezinski. Usually, favorably so. But sometimes he was associated very unfairly through that with anti-Semitism, which he was clearly not. But talk about that.
I mean, it's a really fascinating strand in the book. I mean, you know, if I pick the characters with whom he had really significant historic relationships, obviously Kissinger, obviously Carter, obviously Pope John Paul II. But two of the others that, you know, really come out are Avril Harriman and the rest of, you know, what if they were any other nationality we might call English Americans? The WASP elites, the Georgetown set, who saw him as implacably Polish. It's like, that was a hyphenation, you know, that cast doubts on Brzezinski's Americanness. And he naturalized in 1957, incidentally. And then, you know, on the other side, AIPAC, then under Maurice Amitai, and this is sort of in the build-up to those Camp David talks, you referred to those legendary, I mean, marathon 13-day talks that the Carter undertook and succeeded with. He got a lot of targeting from AIPAC's Maurice Amitai, some various sort of quite fringe extreme figures who accused him of being an anti-Semite, and the, you know, amazing relationship with Menachem Begin, also born in Poland, also a Polish speaker, and somebody who Carter could not stand. Carter was sort of in love with Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian leader. But Begin's sort of obdurate, sort of stubborn sort of refusal to be flexible on anything just, in Carter's own words, hardened his heart. And so Brzezinski became the Begin whisperer. And at a peak moment where there were these scurrilous sort of charges of anti-Semitism against Brzezinski that easily stuck in some quarters because of Poland's, you know, really lamentable history of anti-Semitism, and the fact that Brzezinski hadn't lost his accent, Begin invited him to Blair House, where he was staying for the first time as Israeli prime minister, and he invited photographers. And there, in front of the media, handed Brzezinski a testament from the Golden Notebook of Jerusalem, the Golden Book of Jerusalem, that his father, a Polish diplomat, had given hundreds of passports to German Jews of Polish origin when he was a consul general there in the 30s, where his big partly grew up, by the way, in Leipzig. A really smart and generous act by Begin. The Camp David talks would probably not have been wrapped up. I mean, chiefly they were driven by Carter. This was very much Carter's project. And he said he was prepared to lose election over it. But they would not have been concluded had Brzezinski not been able to forge this relationship with Begin. And you know that lovely story, which I recount in the book, of him and Begin playing chess?
Yes. By the way? Who
2-2.
Won?
2-2.
2-2, yeah.
Each claimed it was 3-1, but I have ascertained that it is in a major scoop that it was 2-2. he said to Brzezinski, I haven't played chess since 1940. And my game was interrupted by the NKVD, you know, the Soviet secret police, who arrested him and detained him, interned him. And halfway through the game, Mrs. Begin walks out and goes, "Ah, my husband, he's always playing chess." I love stories like that.
I love stories. Listen, you mentioned Pope John Paul II. He and Brzezinski had a very important relationship, didn't they? Not just their, you know, their Catholicism. They worked on diplomatic issues, and they really did forge. They both were Polish, but talk about that for a second.
They had met before John Paul II became Pope, and nobody expected him to become Pope. And the KGB, Andropov, head of the KGB, ordered a report into it, and they concluded it was a Brzezinski plot.
Right.
But in reality, the Italian and Spanish cardinals were deadlocked. And so the Germans and the Americans came up with a compromise candidate. And the joke in the White House was, you know, the conclave was deadlocked, so they took a poll. And it was the poll was John Paul II. And he was the first non-Italian in 453 years. Polish speaking, news big. It's big, of course, is Polish speaking. It became a geopolitical relationship of some consequence. And I got all the correspondence and got it all translated. I suppose that the really significant thing about it, I mean, Brzezinski had P for Pope, by the way, on his White House phone. The really significant thing about it is a joke that Brzezinski made to the Pope when they had their first dinner here in D.C. at the Vatican Embassy, that the Pope was more like a world statesman and Jimmy Carter was more like a religious leader. And the Pope found it so funny, he mentions it in letters. And he also keeps joking, but you elected me Pope, so you tell me what to do. And it was a joke, obviously, based on the KGB report. But it was very significant in both preventing Moscow's invasion. They had 18 divisions on the Polish border, and of three of which were East Germany. Imagine if you're a Pole. It's like, oh my God, the Russians and the Germans are doing a pincer invasion again. And they managed both to sort of dissuade Moscow through coordinating Western leaders, Carter, Thatcher, Giscard d'Estaing, Helmut Schmidt, etc., all have exactly the same statements, A. And then B, to restrain the Solidarity leader, Lech Walesa, from some of his more incendiary rhetoric that would give Moscow enough neuralgia to actually go ahead and invade. So both in stealing the Western response and restraining the Polish resistance, as it were.
Yeah, as James noted, he was, in your book, he was so prescient. I remember in the 1970s, you wrote that when they were talking about the Sino-Soviet split, that he said that it was about their clashing national interest, not about their doctrinal splits. That's true today, don't you suspect, for all the talk about the China-Russia alliance?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you were to get sort of clever in projecting not just Brzezinski, but a Kissinger and maybe Kennan into today's situation, you would be playing on that Russian paranoia about China. You know, I mean, it's well known Russia will be the biggest beneficiary of climate change. It's already revealing itself. Those frozen Siberian tundras are becoming arable land. And at the same time, you know, all the Lenin boulevards in those Central Asian capitals, in Bishkek and Almaty and in Yerevan, they're all being replaced by Chinese names because the investors, the power there in the former Soviet Union is Chinese. And there is land hunger in China. So it wouldn't take much not to do a reverse Nixon, Kissinger, and bring Russia into our camp. That's neither desirable nor feasible. But to just prize them apart, to stoke those neuralgias, that's what strategic sort of action involves. Just get more of an equidistance between these three big powers.
Ed, don't count on Witkoff doing that. I'm going to ask one final question and turn it over to James.
Okay.
In those final years, you write, Brzezinski worried much less about foreign adversaries and worried more about whether American democracy would hold. He would worry even more today.
He would. I mean, I have to say, the depth of his knowledge about Russia and Eastern Europe, and then increasingly over his life of the Middle East and China, was not matched by a very nuanced grasp of American politics, I have to say. I think Kissinger really was far more skillful a maneuverer on Capitol Hill and so on. I think he identified sort of key problems with American democracy, but he didn't say anything that you would find strikingly original. You know, he talked about the education system falling behind and second world infrastructure, inequality, things we can all agree on. I mean, it's not like I'm saying he was wrong. And then a certain sort of cultural malaise that he talked about a lot. And he and the Pope would talk about that too. So he was right, but I don't think in a way that, you know, that I put in the category of how acutely he was right on, say, the Soviet Union being a moribund system decades before others were spotting that.
James.
So Ed, I think there's a couple of things that we know. Brzezinski was every bit as smart as Kissinger. That's pretty clear. All right. Very much involved. And Kissinger is by 5-1 more talked about than Brzezinski is. I have a theory, maybe I'm crazy. I think it was because Kissinger was German and Brzezinski was Polish. And I think in a subtle way, that creeped into the, and by the way, the polls are some of the most brilliant mathematicians and stuff that, I mean, we could go do a whole book on, you know, Polish contributions to the world, and you'd run out of ink. But do you think it's possible that their ethnicity shaped somewhat their legacy and the coverage of their legacy?
I think that's a very perceptive comment. I mean, there's something in addition to what you've just said, that the fact that Kissinger's family died in the Holocaust, you know, I think also gave him a sensibility that made him more adaptable to the American system. It made him, he really valued America in a sort of deep sense, and he valued order and stability. Because he saw the Kristallnacht that and then the Holocaust that his family, just his immediate nuclear family, just avoided, but which its extended family got wiped out in. He saw that as a product of chaos, of disorder, of breakdown of order. Brzezinski was on a different track, which is he saw injustice and the Poles having been extinguished once again, and therefore he was prepared to risk, you know, the trade-off between order and justice. Kissinger always chose order. Brzezinski always chose justice. That's and I think that just made him more disruptive.
That's why we have you on, that kind of perception. Thank you so much, and congratulations on a job well done on a really important book.
Yeah, absolutely. And everybody out there, it's called Zbig. That's not hard to remember. Z-B-I-G, which is what everybody called him. And it is really... It's just a fabulous book. Ed Luce, congratulations. And you've always been one of our favorite guests. And today, talking about that book, you know, may be the best of all. So congratulations.
Our most frequent guest, I'm almost sure.
Yeah.
And always delighted to be on guest. Thank you so much, both of you. I really, really enjoyed that.
Thank you. I tell you something, but before this, what you had to do is you had to go to a registered dietitian, you had to make an appointment. There was some rigmarole involved. Mm-hmm. And I could see anybody saying, look, I know I got to eat better, I know I need better diet, but then I don't want to sit in a waiting room and read a magazine and then have this. And now, presto, it's really affordable. It's right there. It's all registered, trained people. And, you know, I changed my diet. And let me tell you, I can't tell you the difference it made in just the way that I feel. But you can do that too.
You know, forget fads. What you eat is always fundamental. It affects your energy levels, your mood, how well you sleep, and your long-term health. That's what's so great about Faye Nutrition. Faye connects you directly with registered dietitians, the real food and nutrition experts, for personalized nutrition counseling tailored specifically for you. The best part is that all dietitians on Faye take insurance, so 95% of people pay zero. Hear that again, zero for their sessions. That's right. This podcast is sponsored by Faye because Faye matches you one-on-one with a dedicated dietitian who will help you understand your body's unique needs. Together, you'll create sustainable, evidence-based programs, not just quick fixes, to help you build healthy habits and achieve your health goals. So now that we found out insurance can get you the dietary guidance you need, nobody has an excuse. Forget one-size-fits-all diet plans. Faye creates a customized program tailored specifically to you. And whether you're trying to lose weight, dealing with low-energy digestive discomfort, navigating food allergies, managing conditions like PCOS or diabetes, you just want clarity in all the confusing diet noise. Personalized guidance could be the exact foundational support that you need. At Faye, they believe expert nutrition counseling should be accessible to everyone. So it's simple to find a dietitian who fits your needs and to instantly check your insurance coverage before signing up. Like I said, the vast majority of people will pay zero for their sessions. I know for a fact that we'll all find any excuse to avoid spending money. But James, I think we agree this is the time to get your health handled. and having a personalized nutritionist costs the big bucks, but not anymore. Thanks to Faye, listeners of Politics War Room can qualify to see a registered dietitian for as little as $0. You heard me right, $0, by visiting FayeNutrition.com/War Room. That's FayeNutrition.com/War Room. One last time, that's FayeNutrition.com/War Room. Make sure you use our URL so they know we sent you. The link is also in our show notes.
So let me make a suggestion to people with this show. Maybe you have a loved one, parent, a brother, sister, a friend, somebody down the street, a child, I don't know, a nephew, that really has a bad diet and would benefit from this. Give it to them as a gift. So you don't have to do it. I'll sign you up.
Yep.
And here you go. And Dad, we, you know, my brother and I want you to be more healthy, and we're giving you this. And it's no trouble at all. What a great way to show another human being that you really care about him. This is it. Start your summer with Faye Nutrition.
And now for the outrage of the week. The University of Florida is one of the best public universities in America. In the U.S. News and World Report survey, it ranks as the 7th best. But Governor Ron DeSantis and even more right-wing yahoos are hell-bent on driving that university to mediocrity, creating so many right-wing litmus tests. They selected former Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse as president. I thought, actually, pretty good choice, though gave too many sweetheart deals to political aides, couldn't stand the controversy, and resigned for family reasons. Then came the saga. They persuaded the University of Michigan president Santa Ono, a respected leader in education, that in return for reversing his positions on racism and equality and all that, Florida would give him more money and make him president. He won approval of the Board of Trustees, but the Board of Governors of the state university system vetoed his appointment based on his previous support, not just for DEI, but for climate change, gender matters, and other issues. It didn't matter that he had capitulated on all those issues and agreed to appointments and policies that would heed the dominant conservative creed in Tallahassee and Gainesville. It's hard to feel sorry for Ono, who sold his intellectual soul for a job he was ultimately denied, while incurring the opposition of both the political left and right. The real loser in all this is a great university that's now a captive of the cancel culture of the right.
You're exactly right. Someone at SEC with him, the University of Florida is a great university. Or maybe I'm talking about in the past tense. I'm not sure. And, you know, it's just so sickening when you look at the entire thing. I can't believe I will note that people like me in Louisiana are distressed that we lost our university president, Bill Tate, to Rutgers, where he'd be taken over as president of Rutgers University. But congratulations to Bill Tate, and you did a great job for us, and I'm sure you do a great job for Rutgers. I want to do my outrage here. And my outrage is, it goes to this thing in Los Angeles that we keep talking about and how we get deflected, right? 25 miles, I think it's 24.7, because I looked at it, from downtown L.A. I used the Staples Center as a reference point because it's right in the middle of downtown. Right out on the Harbor Freeway, you can go to the port of Los Angeles, one of the most important ports in the entire world. And I'm going to read to you, because you want to be sure, from the New York Post, which is owned by Murdoch, which is Fox News in print, right? Uh-huh. Headline, Port of Los Angeles sees sharp drop in cargo ships. West Coast dock workers sit idle. Shipping activity at major West Coast ports has plummeted, with the Port of Los Angeles averaging just 5 ships a day, down from a typical dozen. And job orders for dock workers are falling by nearly 50%, according to port officials. On a typical June day, the Port of Los Angeles would be abuzz with activity, about a dozen ships arriving from majors, contained being unloaded cargo being moved quickly across the country.
but lately things have been eerily quiet.
You are 25, and let me tell you, commerce, people interact with that every day. There's a reason, okay, that people still talk about the economy stupid, any of that, and this is happening. And he knows that's happening, okay? He does not have it. If he hasn't made an agreement with any country. The Chinese are taking him, and our commerce is down from 12 ships a day to 5. We got dock workers sitting there doing nothing while we're sitting here in downtown Los Angeles calling the Marines out for what? I have no idea. I'm just telling you people, this guy is deflecting everything. Don't get deflected. Talk about what really matters to people. Talk about what's really going on and what's really going on at the Port of Los Angeles. And keep and do me a favor, check on the web and see how much commerce is taken there, because that is a very critical and important story. And by the way, all of you journalists out of there, you can jump on the Harbor Freeway. You can set your car compass to 180 degrees, and you will end up at a lethargic place with not much activity.
Hey, here are our listener questions. And man, I tell you, they get better every week, and it's so hard to know which ones not to do. We'll try to get to them next week. Margie in Colorado Springs, Colorado, James, says, of all the crazy stuff the Trump people are doing, I hope RFK Jr.'s gutting of the panel of vaccine advisors does not go unnoticed. Other than contacting Congress, what can we do?
Okay, so first of all, kudos to Colorado Springs. I've been there a number of times. It's a great, great city, great, you know, that Air Force Academy's there. It's a place called Broadmoor, kind of famous on the hot air circuit. But great, great city, great part of the world. So when it comes to vaccines, you understand, this is the greatest, greatest thing that has ever happened in the entire history of public health. It is almost impossible to talk about the number of lives this has saved, the number of grief it's caused. The second thing is, as we like to say on this show, and political people say, it's a large sample size, okay? We have a really large sample size. And like I said, it's the greatest public health intervention in the history of the world. And then we turn our back on that. I mean, it's so idiotic. It's so immoral. It's so out of, this is settled medicine. Totally settled. You'll stop giving people smallpox vaccines? Remember you and I, polio?
Oh my gosh.
Remember when we were kids and your dad was a pediatrician? Yep. Remember you couldn't go out?
Right.
You had to stay in. They were mortified. Everybody knew someone that had polio. You had Dr. Jonas Salk, who maybe the greatest quote in human history, when they asked him if he was going to patent a polio vaccine. And you know what he said? That would be like patenting sunshine. Could you imagine anybody in this world today, or particularly in that administration, to have something that has saved that many lives, that many people from having severe physical handicap? It pisses me off. Beyond pisses me off.
James, do you think that do you think Trump and RFK would consider Jonas Salk a sucker?
Of course he would. Of course he would consider him a sucker. What kind of guy would do that?
Yeah, not make money off it. God damn. Catherine in Williamsport, Maryland, says, who would be the most appropriate person to approach Musk to get him to flip? I hope nobody. I mean, I really like Ro Khanna. He's been a great guest. But his talk about getting Musk to be a Democrat is insane. Musk has embraced the neo-Nazi party in Germany. He, as Bill Gates said, he was the world's richest man, and he caused the death of the world's poorest children with his PEPFAR. The Doge operation was more like a mafia. They would run into offices, clear people out, treat them with brutality. I don't want Ed Musk and the Democratic Party or anywhere near it. I can talk about that. It's just insane.
So let's talk on for a second here, too. This question we do. What I want to happen, there's a very, very serious national security question here. So, first of all, we know that Musk, with Pete Hegseth, was talking to the Chinese.
Right.
And very much knew what the China policy was, what the intelligence was. Now, Musk has enormous business interests in China. And just it's in the news, and remember this, he needs those rare earth materials to make his car, as do other people. We had Big Balls and Booger Puller and Snotnose rummaging through the federal government, taking data. Did you know that they put a Starlink link on top of the White House to transmit all the data they had? You know, when you're in the White House, and you know this, I know it because I've been around, we were not even allowed to go in a situation room. There's nothing in there for you that you want to see. Just stay the hell away from it. Well, did they go in there? Did they take the data? Did they transmit it on the Starlink link that was on top of the White House? All right, not only should we not want this guy to be in a Democratic Party, it's a very, very serious national security question here. I mean, of the first order. How much does he have? And by the way, these guys, that data, they can fire him all they want. And they have pissed off him. And I think this story is long, long way from over.
Yeah.
Long way from over.
And if Democrats take back the House, which I think they will, don't enlist Elon Musk, investigate Elon Musk.
Yeah. I mean, right. we got to find out.
Right.
I mean, I'm saying this requires that we got to find out.
Right. Patrick in Eugene, Oregon. James wants to know, why didn't we start prosecuting employers who knowingly hire undocumented workers?
Yeah, that's always been the way that if you wanted to end it, you could. We have 14 million have been here for a long time. Of course, the business interests would fight that left and right. The agricultural interests would fight that left and right. But yes, if you wanted to not have any you know, immigration of undocumented people here, most of them come here for a simple reason. They want to work.
Yeah,
they commit less crimes than anybody else, than any other group. And you know, yes, there are some nefarious people that come through, but by and large, I've always said, if you got a 28-year-old mother with a 4-year-old or 6-year-old that walks from Guatemala to the U.S. border, I would let her in. I think she's highly motivated. I think this is the kind of citizen we can use in the United States.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, you know, we can do all that, and we can meet Stephen Miller's quotas plus more if we want to shut down most of our construction sites and most of our restaurants and most of our hotels. They contribute an awful lot to the American economy.
And don't forget the contributions to Social Security.
Absolutely. Ken in Williamsburg, Virginia says, in Virginia, we have a Democratic primary next week. I've seen far more ads for her Republican opponent than I have for all the Democrats put together. How concerned should we be? Ken, you know, find other issues to be concerned about. Abigail Spanberger doesn't need ads now. She will have more than enough money. And I think that whole ticket, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and others, I think there's going to be a sweep in Virginia, all held by Republicans now. I think starting next January, all are going to be held by Democrats.
So Don Scott, who, as you know, is a speaker of the Virginia House, so I think he's one of the more interesting people in all of American politics.
We had him on our show in Chicago, right?
We did. Reminds us that, remember, it's not just the gubernatorial race. Now we have the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general elected, but also the state legislature's up. There are 9 seats that Republicans currently hold in districts that Harris carried in 2024. So it is highly likely that when we watch the election returns, not only do we win the gubernatorial race, and I'm going to say it right now, we're going to win. Margin is everything. And the number, and the shock number, I'm hoping, will be the number of seats. I think they call it the House of Delegates there, but it's what you would call the State House. The pickups there, I think, are going to be impressive. And you and I have said this for a long time, and I'll repeat it. This is very important because it will affect recruiting and fundraising and Democratic morale going into 2026, yeah, which is really critical and really important.
I couldn't agree more. Mike in Leavenworth, Kansas. We have a big audience in Leavenworth, Kansas. We can't figure, yeah, we haven't figured out yet whether they're inside or outside, but we have a big audience, and we will take them. He says, with popular Democratic Governor Laura Kelly term limited in 2026, should she run for the Senate? I hadn't thought about that, James.
Well, she is popular. I think she's the head of the Democratic governors now, and congrats to them, because I think they had 23 Democratic governors and put out a joint statement about how outraged they were at the idea that you would call the National Guard, upstate National Guard, out without consulting with the governor of that state. I know Governor Kelly. Let me tell you, man, that is one that she's, man, she's tougher than a nickel steak. I can tell you that. And I if she has, I hope she considers it. But I think that she has a real future that's ahead of her in American politics.
Well, that'd be a bonus if she did. James, next, John in Gurnee, Illinois. I'm going to go to Gurnee one of these days because John or his neighbors are writing in every week with good questions. He says the top 1% now declared class warfare by supporting the GOP and their horrible budget. What steps should Democrats counter if they regain control? First of all, when Democrats regain control, there's going to be a lot of challenges. They have to try to undo a lot of bad things that happen. That's going to cause some dislocations. There's going to be a great temptation to try to do to Republicans what Republicans did to them. I think it's probably, for the most part, be a mistake. But it's whatever the challenges, whatever the difficulties, Lord knows, bring it on soon.
So, thank you. It's not for less. Mary and I were with former Governor Chris Christie in Jersey at the Panetta Institute, and we're being interviewed by Leon Panetta, probably one of the more remarkable, by the way, biographies in literally modern American political history, Leon has. Yeah, we can stipulate that. But one of the, it was a very engaged audience, and one of the questions I got was, what do you think this era will be remembered for? And I think it's pretty clear that it'll be remembered for its corruption and its inequality. And the inequality part of it, of course, we had last week, and I urge people, if you had listened to the show with Evan Osnos, that you should listen to it. And we talked about how does we unwind from this? Because we are living in an era of massive corruption. I mean, corruption like we couldn't even imagine. I'll say this, and I don't think anybody, and I've tried this out on people, and no one's really serious challenges thought. Donald Trump, since he was elected in November of 2024, has amassed a greater fortune, I believe, he has stolen more than every other president put together in the entire history by a factor of 10 times or whatever it is. All right. The corruption that we're seeing right in front of us is literally breathtaking, and it's happening in the middle of some of the greatest inequality that we've seen ever in this country. And this is going to end, and I'm not sure it's going to end in a pretty way.
I'm afraid you're right, James, but it's absolutely, I mean, that dichotomy is just extraordinary. Finally, Bobby in New York City.
All right, Big Bad Kitty from New York City.
We have not gotten a lot of New York City questions.
My feelings are hurt.
Bobby, thank you. Welcome. Come back. Tell your friends and neighbors about it.
Yeah.
He said, he's a listener, James, because in the last episode, you kept talking about how the Democrats need to keep pushing the narrative about budget cuts to veterans. What is he referring to, and who will do it?
Well, it's very hard. This goes back, and we're going to talk about this a little bit, outrage. They don't want you to think about that. So we had the whole veterans thing. We had everything lined up. Of course, he sees this coming. And he literally invades the second largest city in America.
Right.
And at some point, I know it's hard because you got an editor, you got soldiers, you got Marines, you got people on the street, you got all of this. It's being hawked on right-wing media day in and day out. That the question, the right-wing media, shit about veterans, all right?
They're suckers, James.
That's not right. And this is the great political challenge of our time, is how, and again, I go back to Chris Murphy, who I give enormous credit to, how do we not get distracted? Because it's just, when you get more outraged about something else, he just shoves his stacks in the middle of the table and outrages you more. And this is primitive survival. It's not thought out. It's not smart. He's not clever. The only thing he knows, that when he gets in deep trouble, he pulls another stunt to deflect it. But the stuff that's going on with the veterans, what's going on with veteran suicide, I'll repeat again, 17.6 veteran suicide a day. More veterans will commit suicide today than people will get killed or even injured in this stuff that's currently going on in Los Angeles. So the good question, it's the hardest strategic challenge I think that we've ever been faced with, is how do you not get distracted by this outrageous behavior?
Well, we're going to try every week, and I want you all, please keep those questions coming in. They are so good. They are so challenging. You know, we think about them afterwards. And again, if we didn't get to yours this week, send it in again. We'll get to it next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, ZBiotics and Fay Nutrition, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.